Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While the number of worldwide Ebola cases topped 10,000 this past weekend, that number is still dwarfed by a far greater scourge in the tropics, malaria. While very rare in the United States, 500,000 people, mostly young children, die each year from this parasitic disease, with over 500,000,000 infections across the world. My guest today has written a historical account of the fight against malaria, which has had sporadic success over the years, but also pointed out the resiliency of this disease, which has developed resistance to every drug ever used. The Malaria Project, the U.S. government's secret mission to find a miracle cure, is by science journalist Karen Masterson. Masterson's book lays out the history and learning about malaria in the early part of the 20th century, the secret World War II-era experiments to find a miracle cure which was taking thousands of men off the battlefield, and the dubious ethics involved in human experimentation with vaccines in prisons and mental institutions. Karen Masterson is a former political reporter for the Washington Bureau of the Houston Chronicle who left the newspapers to pursue an interest in microbiology. In 2005, she won a Knight Journalism Fellowship to study malaria at the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta and in rural Tanzania. Today, she's a specialist in science writing and is the author of The Malaria Project, which is published by New American Library. Karen Masterson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
This new book, The Malaria Project, puts things in perspective given our current scare about Ebola, because Ebola is a frightful disease, but malaria has been killing millions, literally billions of people for millennia, and still killing 500,000 people each year. And yet it's not really thought of by the average American or the average Western European that much anymore.
Well, that's right. That's because we don't have it anymore. During the first part of the 20th century, malaria was all over the U.S. South. So the U.S. Public Health Service and the Rockefeller Foundation invested a lot of time and money trying to control it. Everybody in the United States knew about it, and it was something that was just a part of the conversation around public health. When we finally eradicated it, it was officially eradicated after World War II, but it was pretty much gone before the war, by the late 1930s, early 1940s. The conversation stopped because we didn't have people sick with malaria, so our mosquitoes, which can still carry malaria, weren't picking it up from the sick and carrying it to the well. So we've not had to worry about it. We still have 1,000 cases or so. Sometimes the number jumps up to about 2,000 per year, but those cases are brought in by travelers who pick it up elsewhere. And then when the diagnosis happens, we have a public health system from the township level all the way up to the federal level to make sure that that one case is contained and does not spread. So that very rarely will a case of a malaria come into this country and then spread to even one additional person.
What I found interesting, I really don't know that much about malaria. I always thought it was a disease simply carried by a certain type of mosquito, but it's really two concentric circles. It's the mosquitoes that carry the virus and a population of infected people that provide the ammunition for the mosquitoes.
That's right. And so the experts who study this disease understand it in terms of a mathematical model that studies the mosquito population and the human population and infection numbers, so that you need a certain number of mosquitoes in an area and a certain number of infected people for an outbreak to occur, because it's actually pretty hard to transmit malaria. The mosquito picks it up in an infected person and has to live for a week to 2 weeks, depending on temperature, so that the parasites that are picked up in the infected person can procreate, they sexually reproduce in the mosquito's gut, and then the offspring get into the mosquito's saliva, and it's when the mosquito bites and the saliva gets into the next person that the disease is transmitted. So in northern regions where you have mosquitoes that don't live longer than a week or two, it is really hard for an outbreak of malaria to occur. You need the right weather conditions that allow that mosquito to live. So the entomologists joke that geriatric mosquitoes are the ones that carry malaria the best. And you have these long-living mosquitoes in the tropics, and especially in sub-Saharan Africa.
You were a political reporter. How did you get interested in microbiology? What was the career path that sort of started you on the path that eventually ended up in this book?
Well, I had been an environmental reporter before I became a political reporter, before I started covering Capitol Hill for a big Texas paper. And so, you know, when I had done the national beat and the congressional beat long enough, I wanted to switch back to science writing and environmental reporting. So to do that, I accepted a fellowship to Johns Hopkins, and I started a project at the National Archives. It had nothing to do with malaria. I was looking for World War II papers of Linus Pauling because I was interested in him, and I thought I might want to write a magazine-length article about him. And so I worked with an archivist to find his papers in the National Archives World War II collection, which is just enormous. You've got a couple million cubic feet of storage space and boxes, and you need an expert to help you find them. And so this archivist helped me locate, through these reference guides, the box of Pauling's World War II papers. And so I put my call slip in, and it came back, and the box did not have his papers in it. And I was frustrated, so I just grabbed a file and decided to read it. And what I pulled out, totally by accident, was a memo to the leading public health official in the state of Massachusetts asking if federal researchers could come in and infect state hospital patients, those schizophrenics and syphilitics especially, with malaria so that new drugs could be tested on the infections. The work was an emergency level priority for the War Department because troops were falling by the tens of thousands from malaria overseas, and the battles were coming to a standstill because of it. So I had never heard this before. I didn't know anything about it, and I just started digging in to see what this memo was all about and found that no one had written about this aspect of World War II and that there was much in the record that had never seen the light of day. I just got sucked in, and I had to take a microbiology course. I took chemistry so I could understand the drug development aspect of it. You know, I tripped on it. It happened gradually, and the next thing I knew, I pieced together this story from hundreds of boxes in the archives.
I'm sure your first reaction was sort of shock of, you know, because that's it was such a different ethic at that time, medical ethic. Right. I mean, we have to remember the Tuskegee experiment was going on in the South just to study the effects of syphilis. And here you have people who are already suffering from schizophrenia or syphilis, and we're going to give them malaria too.
Right. And I turned cold. I thought, This is unethical. And, you know, I wondered, have I just found another Tuskegee? And so that is what drove me into the work. I really felt like this was a story that had never been told and that I needed to tell. As I got to know the context of this research and spent some time with scientists who understood the context of this research, I realized that I had a much bigger story. It wasn't evil scientists doing these totally unethical experiments. It was much more nuanced than that. And I got to appreciate how in medical research, the individual at the time, because now we have much tighter standards, but at the time, the individual really drove the extent to which a drug study would harm or not the test subjects, the clinical subjects. And so for this book, really, I needed to focus on who I thought were the good guys, the guys who were trying to be as ethical as possible as these ethical standards were just crumbling around them because of this emergency that was going on. The War Department was placing an enormous amount of pressure on these scientists to come up with a cure. They had, by the end of 1944, they had a half million troops that had come down with malaria, and they weren't just getting malaria, going in the hospital for a week or two, and then getting back to the front lines. They were contracting strains of malaria that were relapsing faster than these scientists had ever seen before. They were in New Guinea and on Guadalcanal and also in the Mediterranean. And so the troops were clogging up the hospital, taking all the hospital space that would otherwise have been reserved for battle wounds, and they were staying there for months because they'd recover from their first bout with the fevers, and then they'd have a relapse and then another relapse, and they were they were useless to the military, and our military commanders were beside themselves. They were hollering for some kind of relief from this disease.
Yeah, in fact, it was every bit as big an effort as, say, the Manhattan Project. It was a project to figure out how to get rid of malaria, how to keep it from happening. Before we move on to what happened during World War II, as you first learned about this revelation, you met somebody named Bill Collins, who it sounds like the Maytag repairman of the CDC. He's out of, you know, he's not even at the CDC. He's in an outbuilding, and he is like, at the time, he's like one of the few malariologists that the CDC had. And he actually goes back to those dates when they were conducting experiments with syphilitic patients.
That's right. So Bill Collins was not working during World War II on malaria. He came to it in the 1950s and ended up in a state hospital in South Carolina where late-stage syphilitics, that is when the spirochetes have advanced into the brain and now are destroying brain tissue and causing cognitive dysfunction so that they're in these state hospitals. He is there continuing the project that had begun during World War II. So he's picking up where the World War II researchers had left off and infecting these patients with malaria while studying the disease. And the reason why that was considered standard was because malaria was known as a treatment for late-stage syphilis. Medications, even after penicillin arrived, these medications couldn't cross the blood-brain barrier and cure the syphilis infection in the brain. But malarial fevers could boost the immune system to such a degree that in about 30% of cases, it would cure this late-stage syphilis. And people were able to walk out of the state asylums if these fevers were used early enough in this later stage of the progression of syphilis. So he was in the state hospital in South Carolina doing this work until the early 1960s, when there was enough penicillin treating early stages of syphilis so that there weren't any more late-stage syphilis cases. And at the same time, the medical ethics around using these patients in this way, just to study malaria, had come down in a way that made his work no longer acceptable. So, you know, he swept the floor and turned out the lights on this project and brought all his records to the CDC, where he continued researching malaria, but he had to switch to monkeys. He couldn't use people anymore. And that made his work a lot harder. Now, bioethicists have since evaluated his work, this post-World War II work, and found it to be ethically acceptable so that all of the data that he collected on the different strains of malaria and the different species of the malarial parasites are usable. And so today's vaccine developers refer back to his work in their own studies. It was very valuable work that he did. And so I sat next to him, and he helped me understand the context of what was going on during World War II. He kind of brought down that shock element that I was feeling and allowed me, I think, to sit in a non-judgmental way to just tell the story.
In fact, out of that research, you go back to Julius Wagner-Jarig, who actually won the Nobel Prize for Medicine for this relationship between malaria and late-stage syphilis.
That's right. And Jarig was much more careful about how you use malaria to treat syphilis than the malaria experts, these malariologists, were using. So he gave these guidelines. He said, you don't use this type of malaria that you pick up in Africa. It's called falciparum, because that is deadly. You use another species of the parasite called vivax, which you find in Italy. This is at the time. You know, you find in the Mediterranean, you find in South America, you find in these more mild climates, because quinine could treat the infections. If you were to use the strains that people picked up in Africa in this malaria therapy, quinine wasn't reliable. The infections could spiral out of control, and patients died. And so he had these very set limits on how you could use malaria to treat these patients. But when malaria, the field of malaria, picked it up and used his processes to study malaria, those standards broke down, and you had scientists in state hospitals using methods that Jarig would have objected to.
Now, my guest today is Karen Masterson, a former political reporter, now a science journalist. Her new book is titled The Malaria Project, the U.S. government's secret mission to find a miracle cure. It's published by a New American Library, and that took place during World War II as we started out in North Africa with malaria, Southeast Asia with malaria, and it was having a devastating effect on the military. And by this time, malaria researchers have been studying it for a good, 40, 50 years in the United States at this point. You tell the story of Lowell Coggeshall and Dr. Samuel Darling. He was a man who sort of helped Americans complete the Panama Canal by developing some anti-malarial techniques there. He continued his work in the United States. So as the war began, did we have a pretty good understanding of how malaria worked, or were we still trying to figure that out?
Oh, we were still trying to figure that out. We figured out that mosquitoes carried malaria right before the turn of the century. So 1898, scientists understood, okay, finally that mosquitoes carried this disease. It didn't just rise up from the swamps in the air. So the first wave of efforts to control it involved killing mosquitoes. The only drug available at the time was quinine, and it wasn't a very good drug. It made people sick, and it didn't cure the infections. It just brought the amount of microbes in the blood low enough so that the person would survive an attack. But it was no cure. So attacks on mosquitoes, draining swamps, there was something called Paris Green. It was a poison that would be sprayed in waters that couldn't be drained. We focused on mosquitoes because we didn't really have good techniques for studying the parasites. The Germans were getting somewhere with that, and they were using dyes to color the parasites so that they could see them under a microscope better and understand them. But really, the life stages of these parasites are quite complicated. They go through 7 stages, and they become a different creature each time. And the immune system needs to develop a different strategy with each new form that we have in our body. And by the time World War II came along, we understood that there were places in our body that the parasites hid and couldn't be detected by our immune system. They could see that in their studies, but they had no idea where the parasites disappeared to. And they were just starting to figure out that there were these different species of the parasites, and the different species of the parasites would cause different symptoms, so that often malaria fevers went unrecognized because they didn't look like the standards. So during the war, when we had tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of sailors, Marines, and soldiers getting sick, we now had all these blood samples with all these different kinds of strains and different kinds of parasites that they could study. And we had 400 scientists working on this, so that as they were researching and sharing their research in these monthly meetings, they were starting to figure out that malaria wasn't just one disease, it was many diseases, and that they had to address the specific disease to the specific location, so much so that the compounds that they were producing to try to cure the infections had to be calibrated according to the region, so that, you know, one experimental drug might work, 4 grams a week in the Mediterranean, but you need twice that in New Guinea, because the New Guinea strains were much more virulent and relapsed much, much more frequently. Hmm. So this World War II project really brought malaria researchers out of the dark ages and allowed them to figure out probably more about this disease than in any other time in history, but for now, because now finally the genomes of the two major kinds of malaria that we're dealing with today have been mapped. And so the opportunities for vaccine development have just taken off because of that.
Of course, you had a couple of drugs that came on the market. My father was in Southeast Asia, so he remembers, was it Atabrine or Atabrine?
Oh, Atabrine, yeah.
Yeah, and having to take that all the time. He still got malaria anyway.
That was a problem with the drug. It was a terrible drug. It caused gastrointestinal disruptions. Troops were soiling themselves. It caused skin lesions. It caused psychosis. It was a terrible drug, but it was a German drug, and it was the only one that the military had after the Japanese blockaded Java, which is where all the quinine came from. So we had no quinine. We had this horrible drug that the Germans knew how to use, but we didn't know how to use. Hmm. So we were using it improperly, and our guys were getting horribly sick.
In fact, that's sort of the history of malaria. A lot of the drugs, there is been one that's been effective in the post-war years, but the bugs have finally grown resistance to that. And most of the drugs we develop have horrible side effects. You talk about the larium, which was used for a while. It caused hallucinations.
Hallucinations, paranoia, also the gastrointestinal disruptions. And there are some who feel that it has an intoxicating effect on the brain and that it pools there and can stay there for years after you stop taking it. The drugs against malaria have all been pretty brutal. There's one now called Malarone, which is a very good drug. It's expensive, though. We can't use it in the tropics to try to eliminate the disease.
Now, is this the one that comes from a Chinese? Does this come from a Chinese herb?
No, that's the artemisinin. That's the one drug that we use today that was not made by this World War II project. It is derived from this class of drugs called the artemisinins, and they're used in combination to try to prevent resistance from developing. They were first described in the 1960s by Chinese scientists who were tasked with trying to find an herb to stop malaria, and this is the herb that they came up with, Artemisia. It's wormwood. And the West didn't really pick up on it until the 1990s and really developed it with GlaxoSmithKline for use in the tropics and in a way that made it affordable for mass use in areas where people couldn't afford to buy drugs. So that's the one drug that's not from the World War II project, but resistance has already started to develop in Southeast Asia. And so we'll need a new class of drugs, which we don't have, to replace the artemisinins.
Now, it sounds like after the war, and of course the book, The Malaria Project, from my guest, Karen Masterson, tells the story of really what happened during World War II when malaria was felling as many soldiers on the battlefield as the enemy for each side, and talks about all the class of drugs, this quest to find a magic bullet drug, which really malaria has been very resistant to any sort of drug that can stop it. It's an amazing, amazing disease.
Oh, it is. It's complicated. You know, the drugs now either target the parasites that enter when the mosquito bites, which we've not had much success with because that would actually prevent an infection. Or once the parasites enter the liver, where they stay for a while and multiply and feed on our liver cells, they break out into the blood and start attacking blood cells. And it's at that stage where most of our drugs have been able to treat an infection and, depending on the parasite, cure the infections because the parasite at that point is stable and just remaining in that same form so the drugs can attack them. But then, invariably, a few will morph into their next stage because these parasites are shapeshifters. They'll morph into the next stage, which is the sexual stage, and it's at that stage that they circulate into the surface cells, and they emit a chemical that attracts mosquitoes. And so
right.
If you have malaria, you are actually more attractive to mosquitoes than if you don't. And the mosquitoes will come and they'll bite at the site where what I call adult parasites are lingering, and they'll get sucked into the mosquito, and then they're in the gut where they need to be to procreate and to produce the next generation of parasites that are then on by the mosquito.
It's these concentric circles where the infection sort of perpetrates itself. It's a really quite amazing.
You're starting to see the infection rates increase again. And what I took from this research project that I wrote into a book was that the Malaria Project created this paradigm for attacking this problem of malaria that focuses heavily on these technologies, drugs, vaccines, bed nets. Whereas before the war, you attacked malaria with public health. And today, the extent to which this project was the prequel to what's going on with respect to Ebola is instructive. We're approaching this problem of Ebola with the technologies that still are in their infancy that we don't even know what work, like the vaccines and the drugs, when public health on the ground, if used properly and built into the communities like we have here in the United States, you get the containment, you get the education, you get the health professionals on the ground working with people, you know, who are affected by these disease outbreaks, so that containment and prevention become, you know, the number one priority.
Well, with this focus on Ebola, do you expect the work on malaria to go to the back burner, or are there sort of corollary benefits for a whole range of tropical diseases in this continent?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. So if in the paradigm that we operate in now, each disease is looked at individually. There are pipes for money. They in the field, they call them the silos. So you have a silo for funding for malaria. You have a silo for HIV/AIDS. You have a silo for tuberculosis. And now we have this new huge silo for $1 billion that's going to go towards trying to contain Ebola. You break down the silos and start thinking of disease prevention in the tropics as more of a public health matter than a drug delivery problem and a drug development problem or a vaccine development problem and vaccine delivery problem. And you are looking at not only addressing malaria or Ebola or TB or HIV, you're looking at addressing them all. Because when you bring in good public health, you're bringing in much better processes for prevention, and the drugs and vaccines that are developed to treat the actual people who become infected are much more effective because you're containing the problem first. You're getting at the root of these diseases first, and then the drugs and vaccines come in and they work, and you don't see the resistance develop because they're not the only tool. They're not the only approach.
Well, it's a really interesting book about how researchers in Europe and America learned about malaria and how they tried to combat it and how this parasite has been incredibly resilient. And, of course, as we know, malaria goes back to our earliest human writings. It's been around with us forever, and perhaps maybe it always will, but a lot of researchers are trying to change that. The name of the book is The Malaria Project. Karen Masterson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Richard. It was a pleasure being with you.
Science journalist Karen Masterson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled The Malaria Project, The U.S. Government's Secret Mission to Find a Miracle Cure. It's published by New American Library. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.